Hi, my name is Martina and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the long-termers meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at the Aussie Pod 2016. We've got some housekeeping. I'm sure by now you guys know where the toilets are. If you're new, they're right out in the foyer. And the smoking is out and all the way to the right, to the street. For smoking, tea and coffee are in the foyer. It's free. And there's t-shirts and hats in the foyer for sale. And in case there's an emergency, grab your knees. Meet out on the street. Gather there. We will now read the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous. A preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And I'll now hand it over to Elise.
Hi, my name is Elise. I'm an alcoholic. I'll now read Chapter 5, How It Works, from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we couldn't find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we are wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Don't be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought.
Thank you. Just one other reminder, if you can turn your mobiles to silent or off, that would be really great. Just a reminder again that this is being recorded, so you know any of the beeping and the ringing will be picked up in the recording. The format of this meeting is that we've got some long-term guest speakers that will come up and share with you, and we've got this is a topic meeting for our long-time meeting, and the topic is there's a reading. It's abandon yourself to God as you understand God, admit your faults to Him as you and to your fellows, clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. And so I will call our first speaker, who's Kim.
G'day all, I'm Kim and I'm an alcoholic.
Okay.
Member of the Chapter 6 Motorcycle Group. Woohoo! You're enjoying it so far? Geez, I've enjoyed it. Hey, it's been a ripper, hasn't it? I've been trying to think what I'm going to say. And I've been off on about 42 topics. And I've still got no idea what I'm about to say. And I think that's the way it probably should be for me. But just briefly, my sober date was November Melbourne Cup Day 1972, which makes me 43 years. Still a bit of alky in me. Got to exaggerate it. Yeah, I started drinking at the early age of 14. That was my first spiritual experience, without a doubt. Prior to that, as I heard it here today, you know, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And that first drink just made it magic. I was able to do and say and be who I wanted to be. So I chased it, and I chased it hard. And 5 years later, I hit my rock bottom. You know, and it's all that normal stuff that you people have gone through anyway, the DUIs and fights and arguments and the emotional rock bottom, because that's what I hit an emotional rock bottom. And with that, I ended up shooting myself, finished up in Beechworth Mental Institution, finger painting and basket weaving. That was... That was the therapy back in 1972 for alcoholics. I remember jacking up one day and saying, that's it, I'm not going to do any more finger painting. And she says, you'll be back. I said, bullshit, I'm not coming back here. In Alcoholics Anonymous back then, I got nicknamed the one-armed basket weaver from Beechworth. Unbelievable. I really struggled when I came in because I didn't have a higher power, and there wasn't a lot talked about sponsorship, virtually nil. In Sydney, I think there have maybe been two or three people that were taking people through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So our recovery was very, very long back in those days. I love the way that Alcoholics Anonymous now has evolved. It does say that more will be revealed. And I see that young members in Alcoholics today are getting what it's taken some of us 20 and 30 years to get in 6 months, 18 months. And I go, wow. It's lovely to watch the progression in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I've got a good mate of mine, 30 years sober, going through hell, and realised he needed to do something about it. And he went and asked a member with 6 years sobriety to take him through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you should see this man today. Unbelievable. For anybody that has got years up, like, that hasn't been taken through the book, please swallow your pride, get some humility, and go and ask a younger member or older member, doesn't matter who you're asking, to take you through and get what these people have got, because it is priceless, absolutely priceless. I was about 10 years sober, and it all started to happen for me. And it started from the first Young People's Convention, and that was in Newcastle. And I gets a phone call, Kim, we want you to be the first speaker of the Young People's first ever Young People's Convention in Australia. They said, you're the oldest sober young person around. What do you think I said? I'm on board, I'll be there. Lenny from Cessnock was the first chairman, and Lenny and I have still got a wonderful, wonderful relationship. You know, and you know, working with people like that was absolutely fantastic. The second one was down in Canberra, and once again, the numbers grew again, and I didn't get asked to speak. Go figure, Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't they realise when they've got a good speaker, they should get you up all the time? And then came the end of Canberra, the Young People's Convention, and it was chosen back in those days at this meeting, the last meeting. And the nominations would go out. Who wants to put their hand up for next year's Aussie Par? And someone yells out from the back of the crowd, Kim from Guildford. I thought, you're kidding me. And the chairman said, Kim, will you accept that nomination? And I said, absolutely, if my group will support me. And I went back to my group, and my group of Guildford loved me back to life. And they supported me with this. And I go, wow, where's those tissues? No, I don't know. But it brings up that feeling again, that emotion of gratitude. So with that, we got the Young People's Convention going in Sydney. And I might boast, still a bit of alcoholism in me, that was the largest Young People's Convention or national convention ever in Australia. There was something like 1,800 people come through the doors that weekend. It was held at Sydney University, and we slept 800 of them. We introduced steps meetings, topic meetings. We introduced gay and lesbian meetings, transgender meetings. And the older sober members in Sydney
You should have seen him back.
You're going to stuff I up. What do you think you're doing?
You know, absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I can remember standing up at the end of that to close it off and the emotion that I had was the thing that got me and has kept me coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous and to be involved in service. If there's anybody here that hasn't been involved with some sort of service work, and especially something like this weekend, I highly encourage you to get involved in service. The rewards are unbelievable. I'm not talking about a pocket reserve. It just fills you up and you want to give more. Not just in Alcoholics Anonymous. You want to give more when you get out of these doors, into your communities. It teaches you how to be of service. And that's what this program of Alcoholics Anonymous is about. Love and service. You know, and if I can't give that, I'm doing nothing. I heard a member get up not all that long ago, and I think it was his sponsor said to him, "What are you doing in Alcoholics Anonymous?" He said, "Well, I'm going to meetings, I'm a group representative." He said, "Yeah, but what are you doing in Alcoholics Anonymous?" "Oh, well, I'm going to 5 meetings a week." But what are you doing in Alcoholics Anonymous? If you're just coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, you're not doing nothing. You're just coming. That was the message. And I love to be doing something in Alcoholics Anonymous. Why? Because it keeps me sober. There's a couple of things that I think everybody on this panel would agree. Number one, we've all been that desperate that we're staying. You know, and you've got to have that desperation. You know? And the other thing is service. Because if I'm not doing service, I'm coming to meetings and I'm putting my ass on a chair and I'm going to get bored. And I'm not going to come back eventually. I need to be doing something in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been privileged to be on this committee. They asked me to come along as an advisory. How sweet's that? But they said you can't vote. Smart people. And what a great journey it's been to be with this committee. They have just melded together. You get into those committee meetings and this one's got an opinion, that one's got an opinion, and it gets voted on and it gets forgotten. And they go with the group conscience. And I've seen that time and time and time again. And I've watched the committee members here working and doing, and subcommittee, sorry, I've left them out, and subcommittee, out there working and doing their thing for you people. Bullshit. They're doing it for themselves, they're that selfish. Because they want what we all disabled members have got. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kim. Our next speaker is Terry.
Hi everyone, I'm Terry and I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah,
yay. I get what Kim's saying, you know, you get asked to share these things and you get a bit of, it's the worst thing, isn't it, to get told in advance you're going to share it, because your mind's going, what am I going to talk about? And when you've got you know, I've been sober since 1978, so that's 38 years if anyone wants the maths done for them. And, you know, when you're clapping, you're not clapping me, you're clapping God, because truly, you know, it is absolutely in spite of me that I'm sober that long. And the thing is that, came in desperate, no doubt about that, but, you know, within a minute of being here, I knew better. And so, been absolutely in spite of me, and I think a lot of it's been due to a lot of desperation along the way, and being forced, you know, emotionally forced to do the things that I've needed to do to stay sober. And I guess, you know, the other thing that I had going for me was that I had a huge amount of fear that I would go back to what I was like before I got here. And so for a long time in my early recovery, the motivation to do anything and everything was just fear. And I don't think that matters. You know, I used to get up at AA meetings sometimes and I used to say, you know, that I don't think it matters why anybody comes to AA, really. But what I think matters is why they stay eventually. And I'm one of these people that, just to quickly identify, I came into AA because I was... I had burnt every single person who'd come into my general direction, you know. I'd been stealing from my parents, which was just insane, because like they said, we would have freaking given it to you if you'd asked, you know. But I also had a judge who was getting pretty sick of seeing my face and told me so. And a probation officer who said, "Listen, Terry, I'll breach you, you little bitch, if I see you again," you know. And people were starting to get the shits with me, and I'm thinking, what's wrong with everybody? You know, I was just having a great, and I was so absorbed in what I was up to, you know, myself. I couldn't see what they were all so upset about. And I thought it was just this crazy, I really believed it was this crazy phase I was going through. I was just going to grow out of it and be like a normal girl, whatever that was. But I'm the sort of girl that I used to, live with my family, and then, got into the drink, got into the drugs, got into the boys, and pretty much, you know, that was the end of me. And I was telling the girls last night at the meeting, you know, there was this funny incident I remember where I went out, got drunk, got stoned, had my way with one of the boys. And came home, and we had this long corridor down the middle of our house, and my father was down in the back room, and he saw me coming, with this guy, and called us down, you know, come on. And he had some booze on the table. My father, I believe, was an alcoholic, and he had the booze on the table, and he was, you know, come and join me, you know. And anyway, so we're having a drink with my father and the new boyfriend. And my father looks around and he looks at me and he goes, "Your dress is on inside out." And, you know, the boyfriend said, quick as a smart, "I thought it looked funny as we were leaving." So I didn't go out with idiots. But, I was mad. Look, if it was always funny incidents. It was always funny incidents, would have been okay. But you know what? They got sadder. And the boyfriends got sicker, and I was coming home in a terrible state by the end of it. I was a mess, you know. And then I'd move out of home. You can stick your rules. I moved out of home, then I'd come back, move out of home, come back. Right. Always doing that shit. And anyway, eventually, as I said, you know, the cops were into it. And I had this. There was another funny thing about my story. There was a copper who literally was on my case. And I can remember him kicking this door down this place and all the bullshit bravado that they go on about sometimes. And he kicked the door in and he stood in the middle of the room and, people flying him and drugs and, you know, whatever to hide him. And I can remember him saying, "It's Detective Sergeant Bent and you're busted." Everyone just rolled around laughing, you know. It was just such a game with us. It was a game. I can remember all us girls at one stage got hauled into the local Burwood police station, and one of us had the dope on us, and it was like, whose turn is it now? And we were trying to hide it in our pants. It was just stupid. We couldn't find anyone who could take the rap who wasn't going to get in more trouble because they were already on some sort of probation. And we hid the dope in the cop's filing cabinet while they went out to get a police officer, female police officer, to strip searches. And you know, None of us obviously had anything by the time they got around to that, because it was in their filing cabinet. And I used to lie awake on my bed of the night trying to, and I was obsessing about what crime I could commit to get back into the Burwood police station to get it out of the filing cabinet. You know, this is no word of a lie. Anyway, and at one of the more salubrious places that I lived in, I was living on top of a real estate agent in a place called Bexley. Some of you might know Sydney, and it's a nice sort of family suburb. Well, anyway, my sister and I moved in there. You know, oh my God, we chose the place. We were drinking and drugging around the clock, and we had, you know, boys in and out of this place, and we chose it because it had a view, and the view was this long alleyway where you could see anybody coming from a really long distance, you know, and that was important from our strategic point of view. But anyway, the crazy thing about all that was that, the cops came for a raid one night. It was a lovely old flat, and it had the beautiful big old vents around, you know, where you could, I don't know if you get them anymore. But anyway, the point is it had these airing vents at the top, and one of them was smashed. And so, of course, we saw the cops coming, and so we braced and shoved all this stuff down in the vents, and of course it slid down. Well, anyway, they've come, can't find anything, they leave. And I'm saying to these people, you've got to get the shit out of the bloody wall. You've got to get the shit out of the bloody wall. And I had these guys convinced, and next thing I know, all these boys are coming in, lining up, and they've got sledgehammers. They tore that wall apart, trying to get the stuff out of the bloody wall. Seem to recall doing that with cans of drink too, how to get rid of all the cans. Yeah, anyway, it was just madness, one madness after another, but fortunately for me, I was thrown into a rehab program. Cutting a long story short, the judge bonded me to the guy who ran the place, and man, did I hate him. And that was the start of my journey. Part of that rehab was coming to AA. I used to sit up the back and I used to think, it's all right for all you old farts, you need this. Plenty of party left in this girl, you know. And it was just rubbish. You know, I was a mess and didn't know it. And I think the amazing miracle that happened in my life was I had this same thought. The same thought was, why don't I just give this a go for 12 months and see how I go? And if I don't like it, that's it, I'm done. I gave it my best shot. Where did that thought come from? I don't know. But I did that. I decided I would, and before I knew it, in spite of myself, absolutely in spite of myself, I started to get a kick out of it. I 12-stepped both my sisters, and they came in and they got into AA and they got off the dope and the booze themselves. And before I knew it, my life was starting to take on a whole new meaning and a whole new purpose. And I was starting to change, and I was starting to get a kick out of it. I was starting to get a kick out of seeing people recover, you know. And I got to the point where I would 12-step anyone. You're sitting on a bus. I think you need to come to AA. I was mad. I'd literally 12-step anyone. It was just, and I loved it, and I just fell in love with what I saw in this program, and I saw people, you know, in AA, going through the most extraordinary life difficulties, you know, major illnesses, and staying sober through that, major problems in their families, things that I couldn't even imagine someone going through. I saw them staying sober in spite of that. I saw them staying sober in spite of, there was a guy in a group that I belonged to, and he'd been sober for quite a long time, and his daughter had two children by a guy, and the family were really distraught when the guy got access to these children, his grandchildren, and on an access visit he killed the children and he killed himself. And I sometimes think about, you know, that guy coming to meetings after that and staying sober through that, staying sober and trying to help his wife cope with the loss and trying to help his daughter cope with her loss was huge. And this guy would talk from meetings with such grace, you know, and he'd say, God's keeping me sober because people need me right now, you know. And this is the sort of stuff I saw, and it blew me out that there was so much more to this than just not drinking and just not drugging, you know. And I remember different people that I've 12-stepped over the time. You know, I worked in crisis centres when I was early in recovery, and that was fabulous for me. I really worked on the coalface, you know, with people, and it was a great experience. And I got good at it. I got really good at 12-stepping people. I used to have a philosophy, strike while the iron's hot, I used to say. I'd always get them, you know, when they were hungover. That was my mantra. Go get them while they're hungover, because once they're pissed or drunk, they don't want to know, you know. And so I'd send my crew out. We'd go up the cross. We, you know, just had a ball with it. Just absolutely had a ball. And, you know, I'd love to tell you I walked off in the Happy Sober Sunset and all's gone well, but no. You know, I was married, divorced. I had children. They were taken off me. I ended up in prison, believe it or not. I walked through that experience and I stayed sober myself. And some of the things that I'd seen people go through happened to me. And I stayed sober in spite of it, you know. And but at the end of the day, you know, I... all I know is that I have, you know, the big book, I think Angie was talking at Greenslopes the other night, and I just love the talk because there was that enthusiasm, you know. I mean, God really has done for me what I couldn't have done for myself. I know that, and the big book tells me that. And I know that, you know, my sponsor used to say, have confidence in your sobriety, Terry, because, you know, you're never ever just going to find yourself sitting in a bloody pub having a drink. You're never going to just end up going somewhere and put the needle in your arm again, you know. And he said, have confidence in your sobriety because God will look after you, and it promises you that you'll stop fighting anything and anybody, including alcohol, and you'll sit in a place of neutrality. And that's what's happened to me. I've had it all around me at different points of my life, you know, especially when I was working with people who were still drinking and using, you know. And I wasn't tempted. That's the blowout, isn't it? I was not tempted. And I really have known a great freedom and a great happiness simply because I'm sober. And my sponsor said to me, you know, you can look for lots and lots of rewards, because when Andrew asked me if I'd come and share, I said, what do you want me to talk about seriously, Andrew? And he said, well, you know, you got sober when you're young. I think what we would like to hear, what does a sober life look like? As young people, what do we want to, what does that look like, you know? The interesting thing is, it's not mansions, it's not big cars, flashy boyfriends, lots of jewellery, you know, whatever. It's holidays on fucking islands. It's not all that crap, you know? Wish it was. No, I'm only kidding. I'll do the holiday on the island, yeah. But the thing is, what it looks like is, it looks like peace of mind, and it looks like inner contentment, and it looks like friends who are real, you know? And it looks like being able to love and accept love, and being okay with yourself no matter what's going on, you know, and being able to forgive. Hey, who'd have thought? There's a concept, you know. I mean, I have hated my ex-husband's guts for a very, very, very long time, you know. But it's funny, I only saw his face on Facebook recently. I just felt very little. I just thought, you're sick man, you know, just like the book says. We felt, you know, they were sick. And, isn't it interesting that it works? But all I know is, you know, I've still got to watch out for those things that, you know, what's that reading today? Something about being guarded against or whatever it is. Abandon yourself to God. Admit your faults to your fellows. I heard a funny thing. If you can't quite identify your faults, get your ex and your family. Get them all together and ask them. and I thought, oh, God, wouldn't mind have a field day. Jeez, you know. They'd find plenty. I've got 1 minute to go, so and the trapdoor's going to fall. But the other thing that I heard that I thought was beautiful, you know, people have said to me, you know, when I turned 30 and all that, why would you still have to go to those meetings? I've actually got straight friends these days, which is amazing, isn't it? I actually get on with them, and they love me for my madness as well as just me. And the funny thing is that, you know, they say, why would you still have to keep going to meetings after all those times? Haven't you got it yet? You know? And I say, you never stop learning. You just never stop learning. And I love what the kid said earlier today, the one about, you know, I was the person that used to count, and check and check and check, and, you know, all that obsessive thinking. That's me. And I love what, you know, they say about this idea of, you know, think. I think that's of all the cliches, I think that's the most difficult one to figure out. What the hell did they mean by that? If we don't have a problem with thinking, well, what is the problem, you know? But all I know is that this kid said the other day, that's because what we've got to do is we're only allowed to think it three times. See?
always learning something, aren't we? Anyway,
it's just wonderful to be here. And I know one thing, you know, you can always tell if something's working in AA. This is my theory, because I'm a great observer of what goes on, you know. And I know one thing. Like yesterday I worked, I couldn't get here. Last night I went to my home group because I was just buggered and I wanted to be in my home group. And the kids from Moonia, I call them kids, it doesn't matter. Well, you call this long timers. I know I'm getting older. I'm going to do it gracefully, fuckers. So anyway, the thing is that the funny thing about all that is that I saw these kids coming last night and they were on fire. The ones who'd been here yesterday, they were on fire. And they were telling us with great enthusiasm how great it was. And I thought, I've got to get down there tomorrow. Something good's going on. I can feel it, you know? Yeah, so there you go. But, it's great to be here. God bless you all. Keep on keeping on. And I'll see you on the, what do we call it? The road of happy destiny. I'll see you on that road.
Terrific. Thank you. And our next speaker is Tony V.
Thanks very much. My name is Tony, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tony.
And my home group is Brisbane Traditions. And, God, where do I start with my first drink? My sobriety date before that, but sobriety date is Friday, the 16th of November 1984. And I remember that because I was buggered. And so far drunk enough to get here, so far drunk enough to stay. I had my first drink on my 19th birthday. I was pestered into it. I didn't drink before then because I just wasn't interested. That's just the way it was for me. And this guy kept asking me to come and have a drink for my birthday. I said, bugger off, and eventually just to shut him up, I said I would. We drove to this hotel in Shepparton in Victoria, and he brought this beer across, and I looked at it. I had a sip. I said, I don't like this, I want to go home. He just raced the bar, put some lemonade in it, brought it back. I had another sip. I said, it's not so bad, I might finish it. I had four drinks that night, and I said, I'm bored shitless, I want to go home. Nothing happened. No bright lights, no hole in soul filled in, absolutely nothing. I don't remember if I had any more drinks between then and when the car load of us drove down to Melbourne for a New Year's Eve party. I thought, now I'm away from the prying eyes of my parents, I might as well have a few drinks just to celebrate the New Year. So that was the first time I got drunk, first time I blacked out. First time I woke up with a hangover, and I thought, well, the first time I threw up as well, just to finish it off properly. And I thought, well, what did I do it in 19? Drunk, black out, throw up, wake up with a hangover. But the thing is, I didn't do it all the time, just occasionally. Went back to the bush, back to work, I joined sporting clubs to expand my circle of friends. And drinking in my early days wasn't really an issue. I could stop with no problems at all. I didn't even think about stopping. I just did it. But as time went on, I went from sipping to drinking a lot very, very quickly. And towards the end of my drinking, I was drinking purely for effect. I loved the taste, loved the effect, loved everything about it. And the funny thing is, my circle of friends was reducing from the clubs I joined and the people around me too. I would have been very, very happy living in a universe of one myself. Because I had a fear of people, which I couldn't understand why I had fear of people. Fear of places, heights, which I never had before, so I drank more to try and overcome it. Transferred up from Victoria, and actually before I left there, I actually did go to Melbourne Cup one day. Sir John Kerr was there, was a little bit pissed. The crowd booed him roundly, I was one of the crowd. And went home sometime that night. And lost my money, had a few drinks, and that was it. That was the Melbourne Cup, haven't been back to one since. I've been to Beach Road a few times, Beach Road Jail, but as a guest. I walked in and told the prisoners about a few things we were doing and walked out again. Beach Road is a lovely little town, actually. Had a few drinks there while I was there. So anyway, I came up here in 78, and that's when I started drinking more often. I graduated my size of my glasses from 7-ounce glasses to pots. And I went to another town, that's when I discovered $2 flagons of wine because it had more alcohol in it. And I used to have white wine with chook and fish and red wine with fish. So I'd meet and I became a connoisseur of fine wines. It's total crap. $2 flagons are crap, they really were. But in my head, I was a wanker. I really was, you know. I was up myself. Arrogance, critical judgment, all that good stuff, you know. And people started to withdraw from me. I couldn't understand why. And some people used to say, why don't you slow down or give it a break for a while? You're not a bad person when you're sober, but Jesus, you're an asshole when I'm a piss. I couldn't understand why people used to enjoy drinking with me in the early days, and I didn't want to drink with me towards the end. Anyway, I finished up in Sydney, and I ran across this guy, and he was different because he never said to slow down or stop or anything. He just told me his story. He's a member of AA, and he still is. He took me to my first meeting in Gordon in March 84, and I felt conned. I went there, it was an IDA meeting, and I sat there, listened. He said, just listen to the similarities, not the differences. I picked out all the differences. I didn't do that. I'm better than you. I'm not going to do this. I'm fine. I'm in control of my life. After the meeting was over, someone came up and asked me, do you have a problem? I said, no. So I walked off. I had a cup of coffee and a biscuit to look good. I could do that for a short period of time, a few hours at least. And the guy who drove me to the meeting apparently asked me what I think of the meeting. I said it was a load of crap. He was very disappointed, thought a few pennies might have dropped, and not one did. But he just smiled and said, carry on. He didn't shove it down my throat. Just let me wallow in my misery, and that's what I did. A few months later, when the shit hit the fan, somebody made a decision about my life that I had no control over whatsoever. And I was beaten. I was brought to my knees. Physically, I was in good shape because I rode a push bike around Tarramurra, got the hills around Tarramurra. I was very fit. Spiritually, I was very, very ordinary, but mentally, I was absolutely RS. That's what brought me to my knees, my mind. And the book tells me the main problem of alcoholics is in the mind. I went back to my second meeting. As I said, it was on Friday, the 16th of November, 1984, and it was at Bondi. And it just happened to be, what happens in God's time? A lot of good stuff. Just happened to be, for me, a big book study weekend. Joe and Charlie were there, and I said, the guy said, oh, this guy is called Joe and Charlie, they're from America. I hate Yanks. And poppies. And Irish people and everybody else. I said, don't try not to worry about where they're from, just try and listen to the message. So I went in. Drove, and I was picking out pubs on the way to this bloody meeting, just in case this thing didn't work. We went through Darwin University, King's Cross and those places on the way over there. And we walked in. Registration fee was about $20 for the weekend. So what do I do? I said, pay $20, so I did. What do I do next? Buy a big book, so I did. What do I do next? Buy a 12 and 12, so I did. What do I do now? We go inside, sit down, and you shut up and listen. So that's what I did. And we started to go through the book over those 3 days. It was a bloody amazing experience for me. My head needed that. So I probably didn't want it, but that's what I needed. And it started with a forward to the first edition. It says, we're the first 100 people who have recovered from the scene with having stayed in mind and body. I saw the magic figure of 100 and thought, that's it, I'm gone. I could argue with 5, 10, 15 people and win. So I thought, go to a pub and celebrate. For some reason, the 100 just got me. My closed mind started to open just a little bit more. Then he goes on to talk about the doctor's opinion. I have a physical allergy, together with a mental obsession that does not exist in a normal temperate drinker. I saw it and thought, shit, I think I might know what's wrong after all these years. Not convinced, I might know what's wrong. Then he goes on to say, there's no cure for this disease. All we can recommend is total abstinence. Christ, that's a bit bloody rough. My plan was, I'll come in for a few months, get me out together, and go back out there, drink like a normal human being. Fortunately, the book tells me later on, this illusion of every alcoholic has to be smashed. Well, I hadn't got to that part yet. And anyway, I was really, really annoyed with God because I thought I was doing God's will for me and my life. And I left a good job in Queensland in the public service, finished up my arse in AA, and this is not fair. I was so mad and angry and just basically pissed off, you know. If I could have found God and killed him, I would have. But unfortunately for me, when Eddie said to Bill and Bill's story, why don't you choose a God of your own conception? Those words really leapt off the page to me, and I remember thinking to myself, finally, after all these years, I've got a freedom to look at this God thing differently. If this had been another church, another cult, any other organisation, I would have run to the nearest hotel and got drunk. And Joe was very good at saying, Bill wrote these things in the big book. It's squiggly writing that gets your attention. And it's squiggly writing got my attention. And as a result, AA has given me the freedom to change my whole life to what works for me, not necessarily anyone or anybody else or anything else. Guys, I'm going to talk about in the book, Lack of Power is How to Limit. How do we get this power back? Again, well, that's exactly what this book is about. And at least without how it works before. 12 steps. And we had breaks, obviously, over the weekend between the sessions. And this particular guy, might have been the second or third break, said to me, do you know, if you don't pick up the first thing, you won't get drunk. And I was stunned. I said, you're kidding? He said, no, if you don't pick up the first drink, you won't get drunk. Well, Christ, I never thought of that. Smart, rational, marvellous person like myself. I never thought of that. I always blame the last one from the night before for making a sick as a wrong adult the next day. Shit, went up here the first thing, what happened? Amazing. I just got there, really did. And I said, how long have you been sober? He said, 5 years. This prick's really lying now. How the hell did you do that? He said, a day at a time. Oh, that's two different things I heard that session. And he didn't say to me, you're going to stop drinking a day at a time. Just looked at me and asked me, do you think you can try and not drink today? I looked back and I said, yes. But my mind was racing. If you said to me, so-and-so, that I could not have had another drink the rest of my life, I would have told you to shut as the sun don't shine and race to near as hard as I got drunk. But he's smarter than me, obviously. Didn't take much to be smarter than me, particularly in the early days. But he's right. So I still say, I'm sober today. It's great to be here today. Because yesterday's gone, tomorrow's got here. Sometimes I gotta bring my mind back to today. And then I left Sydney, came up here, it was a great weekend, I went to a few meetings down there, and this particular time I went to a meeting, this guy gave me this scrappy piece of paper with a phone number on it. I said, what's this? He said, my phone number. What do you want me to do? Give me a ring. What for? Just to say hello. Okay. So the next morning I woke up, we didn't have mobile phones in those days, no GPS, no nothing, just brick phones. Got up in the morning, had breakfast, walked up to the telephone, scrappy piece of paper. Sydney had 7 numbers in those days. 6, hung it up. 6 numbers, hung it up. Third time, ring, ring, ring. How you going? All right. Had a drink? No. Going to meeting tonight? Yes. See ya. Didn't know how do you feel. What are your emotions like? None of that shit. I went to the meeting that night. He said, how you going? Good. Have you had a drink? No. He said, well, make sure you stay sober. I said, why? He said, well, we can handle you when you're full of shit. We're not interested when you're full of piss and shit. I'll be nice. He said, I am. And he walked off. Okay. So I listened. He got my attention. And so I kept on coming back and coming back and coming back. AA is the easiest, softer way. For me, it's AA or AMN more so now than what it was in 1984. Because my head says it's getting better. My disease lies to me. Sometimes stronger than other times. So I need to keep on turning up. And I come to AA for the fellowship. I can't do this thing by myself. I came up here, I got a job, I was going to meetings, and I go to these meetings and somebody's chairman could ask me, do you want to share? I said, oh, I was right down in back. I come late, hope you didn't notice me, because the buggers always did. So I just get up and say, my name's Tony, I'm an alcoholic, I think I drank too much. I sat down. I was nervous, I was scared, I was sort of just buggered still. But at least I kept on turning up. That was an important thing. I found this group I was told not to join when I was in Sydney, and they were doing things like the big book, they had banners on the walls, they had microphones. I was scared, I thought I was going to run out again. This guy dropped me by the hand and said, come in and sit down. So I did. And I could see it out doing something, but I still had an Irish pride in me. I'll show you, I'll do it my way. I'm not drinking, I'm going to work, I'm going to meetings, yahoo, I'm fine. I nearly drank over it. I said it's meeting one night, thinking, will I go back and drink again and prove I deserve to be here? I didn't think I deserved to be here. Or will I ask for help? Overcome my pride and my fear of asking for help from someone because I thought I'd be stupid if I asked for help. As the big book says, I was at a jumping off point again. So I asked for help, got a sponsor, we started going through a program, and I started to kick goals. And first step I was having problems with, I knew once I started drinking, I couldn't stop. Life unmanageable, I wasn't real sure. He said, well, what happened? I told him, he said, your life was ratchet. Okay. Someone else told him, I believe you. And it says in the first step in 12 and 12 that they had to raise the bottom to put my face, because people were coming to AA, we still had a job, a family, two cars in the garage. So they raised the bottom. I was then able to take step 100%. Went on to step 2, I was still really angry with God, and it says in there, use the groups your high power. That's what I did. And then we went on to 3, made a decision, and to prove I was fair dinkum, that went fast.
Wow.
Sorry. Okay. I better come back. To really fast forward. Service work has been mentioned. I intended to spend a bit more time on it with God and other ideas, obviously. It does. Joe spoke about the three-legged stool and the recovery unit and service as a fellowship. It's a bit like a three-legged stool. If you cut a leg off and go and sit on it, you're going to fall over. Mentally, that made sense. Emotionally, I had no idea what he's talking about until I started to do the steps with a healthy person. Join a group, started to do the traditions, started to do the service work through the concepts. Group representative, general service representative, area delegate for area C when I had that opportunity years ago. And I only got these opportunities not because I'm better than anybody else in any way, shape or form, but because I kept on turning up, showing people, and particularly myself, because I'm my own worst enemy, that I'm reasonably fed in about this program. I try and give back to God. I'll never be able to repay my higher power for what he's given me in my sober life. Never, ever, ever. At least I'll try to do the best of my ability and the help of the fellowship and my sponsor and my group members. My current service position is World Service Delegate Australia. There's nothing special about me again. The GSR provides a link between the group and the district and the area. Delegate provides a link between the area and the group conscious of AA Australia. And the World Service Delegates provide a link between AA Australia and the world. And Bill was adamant about spreading AA from America to the rest of the world as much as possible. If AA had only stayed in America, North America, we would not be here today. People say, why didn't they go overseas and do stuff over there when we need help there? It's all comes here. People struggle in other countries like Fiji, like Honiara, like Thailand, because they don't have the structure there. We're so blessed to have the structure that we have. So we are really duty bound to do 12-step calls on a country-to-country basis. That's what part of all the show is about. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Tony. Our next speaker is Morak.
Hi everybody, I'm Morag, I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hi Morag.
And what an awesome weekend it's been. Thank you to all of you people for making this weekend possible. Let's see if the voice holds out for 15 minutes. Yeah. First of all, for me, it's an absolute honour to sit on this table. My sobriety date is 17th of July 1995. I celebrated my 21st year 2 weeks ago. I owe every single day of that to the God of my understanding. Nothing I did has kept me sober. It has all been my higher power. This chapter, this paragraph in the big book, it's the last paragraph in the first 164 pages, which is the actual program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is my absolute favourite program, paragraph. Mind you, I think I say that about every paragraph I read, but this one really is. And this morning on the way here, I was inspired to look up the word abandoned, because, you know, through therapy, I've learned that abandoned is that, you know, I was abandoned as a child, and blah, 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 blah. And when I looked it up, it actually means the verb definition of abandoned means to give up control. And that's what I've been doing for the last 21 years, is giving up control of everything in my life. And it started before I came into AA. I didn't come into AA willingly. Well, I did come in willingly, but I didn't come in through probably the conventional ways. My dad was an alcoholic. My dad is an alcoholic, sober, but not in this program. I say sober and not recovered because there's a difference between somebody putting the alcohol down and actually living this way of life. And I love my dad dearly, and he's not recovered from alcoholism. So I had a picture of what an alcoholic looked like, and it didn't look like me. I didn't drink daily. I was still a party girl. I went out 3 or 4 times a week. But, you know, when I talk to people who are non-alcoholic and they go 3 or 4 times a week, that's a bit. And I go, no, it wasn't. It was like, it wasn't every day. And so I was a binge drinker, and my life had just got to a point where enough was enough. And I couldn't cope with how and what was going on for me emotionally. I couldn't stand who I was anymore. And at the same time, on Melrose Place, Alison went into a rehab and she got sober in 3 episodes. So there was hope for me yet. So I found myself in a rehab because, you know, I didn't want to come here. My dad had been to one meeting when I was 15 and he said it was a bunch of old farts sitting around a room talking about shit. And I've been to those meetings, so I get what he was talking about. And I got sober in those meetings, actually. So I went to a rehab up in Toowoomba. They introduced me to AA, and through that I've started my journey on this most amazing life that I live today. It's just, you know, you can't imagine. You know, it talks about in the big book about this power is infinite power. You haven't got enough. I didn't have enough imagination to know what was going to be handed to me through this program. And, you know, and I've had the riches, I've had the good jobs, I've had the great cars, I've had all that stuff, sold it all, chased a crazy obsession overseas, came back with nothing, bought a $2,000 bloody beat-up car that the boot would flip up as I was driving up the highway. Get out, Grandma. So I've had everything in AA, and the thing that this program has given me the most is the relationship I have with my higher power today, with my God, which I call God today. When I came in here, I didn't really care. I didn't care that the word God was there. I thought I had no prejudice until I went through the program, and then I still had lots of prejudice. But I had no hang-ups with any sort of religion because I didn't have a religious upbringing. I got kicked out of Sunday school. I used to say I got kicked out of Sunday school for beating up the boys, and Mum told me a few years ago it was because I had chicken pox. Bugger. All those cool stories I had, they aren't there anymore. And, I just love what this power gives me. You know, people have talked about enthusiasm. The enthusiasm of this committee, it's actually the first committee I've ever sat on. I've neatly evaded, I think through fear of not sitting on a committee until this year. And I just couldn't wait to do this one. It was like, yeah, I'm doing it. And I'm signing up for next year again. And, you know, there'll be more and more and more. And but the enthusiasm, and enthusiasm means inspired by God. And that's what we are, you know. Look around at everyone in this room. We're all a miracle in here, every single one of us. And if you don't believe you are, look at the person beside you, because they are. You know, we're all a miracle in here. And I abandon myself to God. I give up control to God every single day. For years in this program, I had a person who took me through the big book when I first got sober. They took me through the steps formally, and they said, off you go live life. And I did. And I didn't really do much with the big book for about 12 years. And then I met a man who started taking me through the big book through his manipulation and introduced me to big book studies. And I say manipulation because it was. And he knew I had an enormous fear of reading in front of people. So he knew how to manipulate me, in a very loving and kind way, of course, to introduce me into this. And he showed me how to start reading this book. And in turn, I started reading this book with other people. And then in turn, I've learned more and more. Every time I read this book with somebody, you know, which is usually 7 days a week, I'm reading this book with someone, I learn something more. I learn something more about me. I learn something more about my higher power. I learn something more about how incredible this program is. My first big book, it's got all the colours through it. It's all highlighted, but it wasn't highlighted because I really related. I highlighted it because my sponsor then would say, oh, good girl, Morag. You know, Pat, you've done your work. I didn't bloody read half of it, I'm sure. And now it's like, you know, I don't necessarily highlight it, but it's underlined. There's words all over and things like that. And for my 20th birthday last year, I decided to deflate my ego and get rid of my 20-year-old big book that looked 20 years old. It's up on the bookshelf at home. And I bought myself a new one. And the cover's already fallen off. So I don't think they're making as good as they used to. Or maybe I'm using it a bit more. You know, I give up the control, you know, to this power. And for years, I thought, you know, I'd say that third step prayer and I'd hand my will and my life over to God. And then I'd go, and then could you please do this, this, and this, and this for me? And then I'd say, I'll give you the alcohol, God, freely. I'll give you the alcohol, I'll give you drugs, I'll give you this and that. But I'm going to keep the chocolate. I'm going to keep the sex. I'm going to keep the money because you just don't need anything to do with any of that. So I kept controlling my life. I kept controlling aspects of my life or kept wanting the control for the outcome of what was about to happen in my life. And over the years, I remember hearing this statement when I was very young, and it said, whatever you put before your recovery, your disease will take away. And that has been absolutely true in my life. Everything I put before my recovery, a job, a relationship, my dog even, every single thing has been stripped away from me. So I was bare and I was raw and I was able to give everything of me to this power. And today it is just, there are no words. You know, the feeling I have is such a spirit inside of me that just lightens up. And I see it in people, and you know, I see people who have this spirit in their eyes, and I just fall in love with them. I'm just like, oh my God, I love you. Like, I know who you are. I've seen people in the airport with this spirit in their eyes, and I go, oh, I love them. And stalker. Yay. You know, at least I do it like friendly these days. And it's just, this just keeps getting better and better. You know, I have more energy today than I did 21 years ago. I was just sitting there thinking, well, this is the first time I've sat down in like 2.5 days. Oh my God, it's so nice. And just sitting here and being here. I think I've had 6 hours sleep in the last 2 days and I reckon I could go another dance. Let's go. Yeah, see me at about 5:30 driving back to Brisbane. Oh God, I'm done. You know, it's just, you know, if you are new to this program, and please welcome everybody from the rehab who came to here. If you are new, if you are old in this program, because, you know, there's a belief that you've got time up, that you're well. And for my, you know, I was 15 years sober and I wasn't really well. And so it's not always the truth. You know, if you haven't gone through this big book with somebody, get someone to take you through this big book. You know, get them page by page, word by word. Have a dictionary beside you. If you don't understand it, look it up. I had to do all that. You know, this program will, you can recreate your life into whatever you want it to be. You know, I never thought at, you know, 21. I remember when I came in, I was 25 years of age when I got sober. And I sat there going, so if I live to be 75, I'm going to get 50 years up. Yeah. And I'm almost there. I've got 29 more to go. Is that right, Mass? Is that right, Mass? Ran out of fingers. Yeah, so it's just amazing. You know, it's just an amazing life. Please, please get someone to take you through this big book if you haven't got somebody already. You know, there's plenty of people sitting in this room that know how to read this book the way it was meant to be read, you know, to be shown to people. I love this program. I love this God of mine. You know, this power is just, it fills my soul with, you know, makes my soul sing. And if any of you here last night, I have a little tendency to love dancing, makes me dance inside. You know, I love it. I love every single person that walks through these doors. Might not like you all, you know, like me, I can be an asshole too sometimes. And that's why I have a program, because then I can make amends. But every single person that comes through here, you are a miracle. You are a gift from God to every single one of us. I know God plucked me out of the crowd that I was hanging out with, smacked me on the ass and said, I've got work for you to do, girly, and I've been doing that work ever since. God bless you all. Thank you for a great convention.
Thank you so much, Morag. Our final speaker is Richard.
Friends, my name's Richard and I'm alcoholic.
Hey, Richard.
And a few of the words popped out to me. One was trudging. I won't do it. Because for me, trudging is like painful, taking time, not a good experience. That hasn't been my experience in recovery. Mine's more been skipping. I've actually had an experience of love and light in recovery, and I'm really grateful for that. It's got something to do with God, and it's got something to do with the steps, and it's got something to do with human beings. I shared earlier today, I felt a bit selfish, but I was asked, so we talked about mammals. Well, I talked about mammals, and I talked about lizards, and I talked about snakes, and I've been called a snake once, and I identified with that. Didn't identify with being a human being. I'd missed that. Something actually that I really identified as a human being was I felt love, fear, resentment, what I believed more than everyone else. I really didn't like the way I felt. And those feelings of intensity, even almost to this day, I still believe I even felt them more than you. You know, my brothers and sisters, that intensity of feeling, and it near killed me. So when I actually had my first drunk, it went away. It just opened me up. I loved it. I loved it. I don't remember the first drink. I've got inklings of when it was, but that first drunk was very important. But I didn't become addicted to it straight away. I was very lucky. I got addicted to a thing called Mandrax in King's Cross. The older of us would remember it was like a bottle of gin every pill. And I ended up with a habit of about 7 or 8 a day. Excuse me. And with that came everything that King's Cross had to offer in the late 70s. And just to give you a little picture, because it went from an 8-minute share to a 15-minute share, so I can fill in the dots a little bit. There was a bar in King's Cross called the Way Out Bar, and I was about 17 years of age. And all the kingpins would hang around there, and I was just sort of like a little boy, you know, really. I'd have a few drinks, I'd have a few Mandrax, I'd have a bit of this, I'd have a bit of that, and I thought I was actually living life. And this man came up to me. And I had a girlfriend at the time. I think she was about 7 months pregnant, but the child wasn't mine. And he came up to us and he said, you want to make some money? Do you want to, you know, make some big money? And I won't go into too much of the story because this is being taped, but it regarded killing someone. And it was a pseudo-sexual situation. And it was actually a scam. The guy was scamming me, myself and my girlfriend, but I didn't know that. And the fact of the matter is I agreed to it. I agreed to kill somebody for $10,000. And for that I get $5,000. You know, so we have a moral code. My moral code was given to me by my mother, but I was throwing it away very early in the piece, you know, 17 years of age. And from that it got worse for me. You know, where my life ended up was a lot of times you could make it into a pretty picture, but the reality of it was pretty depressing, you know, pretty sad. But my ego would kick in after about 2 days. Morag talked about how much he drank. Most of you drank more than me. You know, I could drink every third day, every second day. But once the feeling started to come back, that incredible unlightness of being, you know, the fear, the anxiety, resentments that, you know, I could just remember the last drunk. I couldn't go back further than that because the booze was working. It would just come in and I'd go for it, you know, I'd go for it. I'm very lucky, you know, very lucky. It doesn't sound like a lucky story, but I'm very lucky I'm alive. You know, I've got that. So I've got the gratitude. Step forward a few years to about the age of about 27, which was about 1987. I couldn't earn a living doing what I was doing. It was catching up with me. I was like 26, 27, and I was too old. Get that? And I felt too old too. To be 27 or 28 and really feel like your life's over. But I really wanted to kill people more than I wanted actually suicide, because my resentments were quite full on. But get me, I wasn't doing it. It was all in my head. I lived in fantasy. I wanted to, you know, one of them was jumping off the NLC Centre with a machine gun on a bungee jump, you know, just victims. You know, I felt like I invented terrorism in my head. Oh, what a nightmare. Anyway, I met this man, and he was similar to someone that was sharing earlier about 12-stepping anyone, you know, if they'd listen. And this man caught in me in a locker room. There's only about five or six lockers, and he turned around and he said, my name is Mark, and I'm an alcoholic. And I thought to myself, I didn't say it, I thought, and you're an idiot too. Why are you telling me? And really, he didn't know. He didn't know anything about me. We'd just met. But there was one of the rare times that I actually felt better than someone, and I wasn't drunk. Because I always felt less than sober, better than drunk. There was no equal. There was no, you know, there was no human being thing going on, you know. And the situation arose where I was going to lose my job, and I went to a meeting with Mark. And there again, I totally understood that. You know, I'm an intelligent guy, you know, I thought. Problem was, you were there, you know, human beings, you know. There's my mum, there's my dad, there's my sister, there's my brothers, you know, and I don't like you. I don't like people. You let me down. So I tried to do it myself. So I went through the scenario of not drinking on self-will. It was quite an interesting situation. As long as I could just remember, don't drink, don't drink, don't drink, you know, and try chanting that for 5 weeks. It's a fucking headache. And it was like fingernails. There were no fingernails, but it was like that. And there was an out-of-body experience where I sort of came out of myself and, like, Golan or whatever you call him, and you really feel like a drink now? And I said, yes, I do. And I went and had one. And for a few people in the room, they would understand. I sort of ended up in the Unicorn Hotel waking up next to a guy and a transsexual. And then I robbed them. You know what I mean? Like, that wasn't the unusual part. Robbing them wasn't unusual. The normality of my life had come back once I picked up a drink, once I picked up a drug. You know, so the horror show began again and again and again. I went to a meeting in about 1987, 1988, and it was down at Woolloomooloo, and there was about 300 people there. And I thought, I really like this, but I can hide in it too. I can be a bit anonymous. And I walked out the front of that meeting after it had finished, and the beautiful people were over there. You know, and I was pretty young. Maybe I was beautiful, I don't know, but I certainly didn't feel it. And one of the guys came over to me, and I thought, oh, they've spotted me, they're going to ask me out with them, you know? And he said, Richard, are you enjoying your sobriety yet? And I went, huh? And he said, tell your face. Why? Yeah, that's really not very nice, is it? You know, what a prick. And, you know, you know what I learned from that? And the 12 steps of recovery have helped me learn this sort of stuff. I am so self-centered. I drank on that. You know, I lived on that. You know, how dare everyone in this room is like that? You know, they're just like everyone else. There's no love, there's no kindness. You know, what's God? I used to stub cigarettes out of my hands to show people, like stigmata. You know, crazy, make lights flicker in my head. You know, I'll become invisible. When Barry from the Gold Coast talks sometimes, and he talks with his hands a lot, I can understand his language. You know, I mean, I'm there. So what happened for me? I just got sick and tired of grey-headed guys getting up here with consistency in their recovery. because every time I had an emotion that I didn't know I was having, I'd find a bloody Heineken in my hand, or drugs, which led to Heineken 12 hours later. You know, it was a simple equation, but I just couldn't get it, could not get it. You know what was happening? And I didn't know it at the time. I had no God in my life. I had no God. Now, I don't call God Jesus, I don't call God Muhammad, I don't call God any name. For me, it's power. And I was lacking power. Power was my dilemma. And I kept on drinking, and for about 2.5 years, 3 years, I had zilch recovery. Longest I ever got was 9 months up. That ended up on the end of a bottle of wine. And I met this guy in Sydney, and he was a nuts and bolts sort of guy, and he talked about getting a piece of paper, he talked about getting a ruler, he talked about getting coloured pens, and I thought, okay, but I added, I'll have to move to Queensland to do it. So I got all those things and moved up to the Gold Coast, which was funnily about 3 kilometres away from my father, and you wouldn't believe this geezer, and I think you know him, American guy from Chicago, grabbed me, and you know, he was sharing at Southport, and I grabbed him, and I said, he said the same things, and I said, I really need help. And he took me in his crappy combi van, he took me to Burley, and he said, Richard, read the third step prayer out to me. You know, and I read it out to him, and he said, read it out to me again, and I read it out to him again, but I started to get a feeling, you know, and I'm not talking religion. And then he said, read it out again. And I said, not to him, but to myself, who is this asshole making me read it out 3 times? And I got angry. I got angry with this man. I read the thing out. He didn't know I was angry, you know, poker face. And I read this prayer out to him. And then he turned around, he did something even weirder. He turned around and he said, I'm a bit short of petrol money. And he stung me for $20. Nothing's new in Richard's world. Everything's money, money, money. It always costs. There's always something. Wait for it. It's coming. So I give him the $20. Next day, I began my fourth step. You know, I was 18. I was probably about 16 months sober at that time, and I'd been mucking around with AA for 3 years before that, so it was about 4.5 years, you know? And me getting angry with him was enough to bypass the fear. You know, for me, this is my story, this is how it happened for me. And I'm grateful for that man. I shared about this week, that exact same story, and a man was in the rooms down in Sydney, I was down in Sydney, and his name's Boomerang something or other. A few of you may know the man. I don't know his other name, but it's Boomerang. And he ran up to me with a little piece of paper and he stuck it in my hand. I was feeling hyper. Sometimes after you share, you can feel a bit hyper. I'm sure you've all felt it. And he stuck it and I put it straight in my pocket and I thought he'd written me a poem or something, you know? His phone number or whatever. And he'd call him Boomerang because he keeps on coming back and he kept on coming back to me. He said, you've read it or you good? And I said, I got it out and opened it up and it was a $20 note. And he said, the debt's clear. You don't have to hold... I really didn't have a resentment about the $20, but who knows what level it is in my consciousness. You know, because I don't know what's going on. When I think I know what's going on, I think I know what you need to hear. You know, these little miracles, these little miracles. That's the 1 minute warning. I don't trudge anymore. As I said, it's like a butterfly. I've had friends die in recovery and I've loved people. You know, I've had that experience of love. I remember there used to be this man at Stella Maris when I got sober and he said, watch out for the resurgence of ego. I never knew what he meant. But I've experienced it, you know. I've experienced sobriety Richard's way. I've experienced what Morag was talking about of chasing a dollar, you know, and then learning to let it go. You know, I've experienced having a job and experiencing the miracle of nearly dying going to that job emotionally and then finding out that if you went back to that job you would be dead because of a health situation. I mean, life is a miracle, and life is you don't know what's going to happen next. You know, so I've learned to live every day as it comes because I'm really grateful for having that day. And I've had a lot of young men come into my life recently, and they trust me and they're telling me their stories and they want to go through this with me. I always thought that because I was a seaman that was here for 5 weeks and gone for 5 weeks, that I really had nothing to offer. You know, and people wouldn't ask me, so I started to, maybe they don't like, but they're here. Maybe I'm not good enough, you know. I'm a human being, I can go that way. Alcoholic. And I've found that since I've become available and been in a stable place for a period of time, I've got to grow with these men, you know. And they love me. They love me. They tell me they're shit, you know what I mean? And you know what? It's the same smell as I have. We're all the friggin' same, you know. We are all the same. So if you knew, I don't know if you knew or not, you know. But I'm really grateful to Mark, who held his hand out to me in 1987. I didn't get sober till 1990, but in 1987 he held his hand out to me and he said, "Mark, I'm an alcoholic." And I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that for 10 years, you know, because I was frightened. And I'm not frightened anymore, you know. I'm not frightened anymore. Well, you know, if you had a gun, I would be. You know, let's be normal. But it's not yesterday, it's not tomorrow anymore, so thank you.
Thank you to all our guest speakers. We've got a few announcements. And after that, we're going to do the sobriety countdown, so don't go anywhere. And we're going to give our big book that I hope everybody signed to our newest member. Like I mentioned, this meeting and all the meetings this weekend have been recorded, and they're going to be available for free to download. So go back to our website in the next week or two, at the end of the week. And there'll be a link for you to just click on and just download for free, or you can listen to it right from your computer or your phone or whatever device you want to. So if you don't have that technology, you can call any of us on the committee and we can get that information to you, whether on a CD or whatever. So this whole weekend is available again for free. Let's all join in the serenity prayer.
Guys, don't